Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Shop class used to be just for boys. Now it's disappeared almost altogether. In our quest to produce knowledge workers for the information age, we make it hard for people, boys and girls, to aspire and train for work in the manual trades. But now in a new book, philosopher, electrician, and bike mechanic Matthew Crawford describes the deep satisfaction of making and fixing things. And he argues pressures in today's economy offer opportunities for people who feel ill-suited for work in an office. His new book is titled Shop Class as Soul Craft. Motorcycle shop owner Matthew Crawford joins me in the studio, and of course, we'll take your calls. Just dial 800-433-8850 or send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Matthew. It's good to have you here.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for
having me.
You
know, just before the show started, I was telling you that when I went to junior high school and a high school, there were all these shops, mechanical drawing, bike repair, all kinds of things to do with the hands. There were sewing classes and cooking classes for girls, of course, very few boys in there. What's happened?
Well, it's a complicated story, but the short version is that in the 1990s, shop classes were pretty widely dismantled. And the rationale varied, but a big part of it was to make room for computer classes. And shop, I think, was attractive as something to cut because it's expensive, it's potentially dangerous. And at the same time, I think there was a kind of ideology developing of this distinction between knowledge work and manual work, as though they were two very distinct things. And that's not a distinction that really makes sense to me as a practitioner, because I think there's just a lot of thinking that goes on in the trades. And using your hand and using your mind seem to be deeply connected.
Absolutely. What happened to you? You studied philosophy. You had your undergraduate degree. You went on to learn even more and to work in an office. What happened?
Well, I absolutely loved graduate school. I loved studying philosophy. And Chicago is an amazing place for ideas. And but when I finished the degree, the academic job market was really depressing. I had
friends who
had bounced around in 1 year, visiting appointments all around the country, unable to settle down. And I ended up landing a job at a policy organization in Washington, and that felt like a real coup. But it turned out to not. It turned out to be something that I was very ill-suited to, and I lasted about 5 months. And that's when I quit to open the motorcycle repair shop.
Tell me what you were asked to do in that desk job and how your graduate degree in philosophy was supposed to figure into that.
Right. Well, the think tank sort of... it sounds like a very academic-y kind of thing, but it's actually quite different from what you do in a university. Like any policy organization, this one had arrived at certain positions, and I often found that I had to reason backwards, as it were, from some desired conclusion from some conclusion to a suitable premise. So, you know, there were some facts that we were more fond of than others at the think tank. And so I found myself making arguments that I didn't fully buy myself. And so that was kind of demoralizing.
So you realize that all this education you had had somehow did not jibe with what you found yourself doing.
Yeah, it often felt like my job was to project a kind of image of rational inquiry, sort of disinterested investigation. But in fact, I couldn't indulge in too much actual reasoning because it might lead in the wrong direction.
But opening a motorcycle shop is a pretty long way from doing thinking at a Washington think tank.
Yeah, well, I suppose it was a kind of antidote to that. And one thing I love about it is that the work feels genuinely rational. I remember when I first started, it made for some awkward moments at cocktail parties because people would ask what I do, and I say, I fix motorcycles. And there'd often be this moment of silence.
As though you couldn't possibly know anything about anything else but motorcycles.
Well, I think what made it awkward is that the other person would be feeling slight embarrassment, and I would be feeling pride, and the two just didn't quite match up.
Matthew Crawford, he's a philosopher and a mechanic and author of Shop Class as Soul Craft, an inquiry into the value of work. I do invite your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org as we think about all the people who are currently out of work, and most especially in Detroit. With GM going bankrupt, many of those people who've worked in the GM plants have, in fact, worked with their hands. And for years, I kept hearing people say, well, you have to get more education, be ready for the next thing with better education so you won't just have to work with your hands, that perhaps you'll work with computers. And now that's the thinking, that somehow the computer has supplanted the need for the use of your hands.
Yeah, I think there's this idea that's been prevalent for, I don't know, maybe 20 years now, that somehow we're going to take leave of material reality and sort of glide around in a pure information economy. And, you know, ultimately somebody has to actually do things and make things. I mean, that's obviously the basis of any economy, is some activity that's actually productive.
So for whom have you written this book?
Well, I guess for a number of people. Partly it's addressed to a young person who I imagine might be reading it. And so let me tell you a story. I briefly taught high school part-time for a year. And they had me teaching Latin. And I was very excited to do this. The principal said, our Latin program is growing. It's, you know, I thought, wow, maybe there's a resurgence of interest in classical civilization. Well, that was very naive. What it turned out to be is that these were kids who were told they had to take Latin to get their SAT scores up. And I think maybe one out of 30 of these kids had a real interest in the language, and the rest of them were really pretty disengaged. I'm sure part of that is just I'm not very gifted as a teacher. But I kept thinking that if I could have taken some of these kids aside and say, hey, let's build a deck together, or let's overhaul an engine, that they would have perked right up. I mean, half of them were jacked up on Ritalin just as in an effort to stay awake in this class. So I think there's a question of what sparks that love of learning. And some kids, including some kids who are very smart, would rather be learning to build things or fix things.
Did you find some in that class you were teaching?
Well, I didn't really have, there was no institutional sort of support for doing that kind of mentoring. I love the idea of teaching what I've learned as a mechanic to somebody. I think one problem as a society is that there isn't much institutional home for that kind of transmission of some very important knowledge.
Did you begin fixing things as quite a young man?
Well, one of my first jobs was when I was 15. I started working at a Porsche shop. This is an independent Porsche garage in California. And I didn't actually learn that much working there. I was sort of a slave, really. I mean, the owner of the shop lived above the shop, so he had me cleaning his apartment for the first week. But I did learn a few things. And then later I had a real mentor who taught me how to rebuild a Volkswagen engine. And he was part of the whole sort of hot rod scene. There's a big Volkswagen hot rod scene. And that was an exciting world to sort of get to become a part of when I was about 17.
And that sort of stuck in your brain.
Yeah.
Even as you went off on this highly intellectual path.
It did. I always missed it. Going to grad school in Chicago, you know, in the winter, there might be a foot of snow on the ground that lingers for months and months. So if there is something wrong with my car, I had no place to work on it, you know, living in an apartment. So I'd end up taking it to a garage, and it just killed me to have someone else fix my car.
Matthew Crawford. His new book is titled Shop Class as Soul Craft. Short break. Right back. And here's our first email for Matthew Crawford, who describes himself and is both a philosopher and a mechanic, having earned his graduate degree in philosophy from the University of Chicago. 8 years of study there, exactly as our son did. And he is also a mechanic, the author, the owner of a motorcycle repair shop. Here's an email from Jared, who says, I've always had a strong propensity and talent in mechanical electrical aptitudes. I worked as a technician for over 13 years. I earned a BA in anthropology in 1995 and an MBA in 2008. And now work in a cubicle doing work that is at least to me less than satisfying, non-rewarding, and fairly boring. How can I leverage my broad skill set doing something I love while maintaining an equitable income? And that's the worry always, mm-hmm. isn't it? Mm-hmm. Can someone who loves to work with his or her hands make the kind of money needed in this society?
Yeah, there's some interesting arguments made by economists on just that point. And to begin with, there's apparently repair shops have seen their business jump hugely in this recession because people aren't buying new cars. They're fixing the ones that they have. So the argument made by an economist named Alan Blinder at Princeton is that the emerging distinction in the labor market is not between those who have more education and those who have less. It's between those who do have some service that has to be done on site versus one that can be delivered over a wire. So, for example, radiologists who examine images, well, that work can now be done in India because an image can be transmitted over the internet. I once got an article that I had written. I got comments back from an editor in the Philippines. That was sort of eye-opening. Whereas work that has to be done on site isn't subject to that logic. As Blinder says, you can't hammer a nail over the internet. So there's a sort of surprising effect that information technology has actually made some careers in the trades more attractive because they can't be outsourced.
Then the question is, do you believe that college is right and or necessary for everybody?
I think there are beautiful reasons to go to college. The life of the mind is something that has been a big part of my life. The economic rationale for it doesn't always turn out to be a good one. So if we were going into it sort of in a cold-eyed way, as I think we have to when we're making that kind of investment, it sometimes turns out in retrospect to have been really a form of consumption rather than investment. If, you know, you end up with a degree in sociology or something and become, you know, a telemarketer or something, well, you might have studied electrical work and made more money doing that. And so there's this perception, I think, that there's only one track to success, and it leads through, you know, a series of gates controlled by prestigious institutions, and that everyone has to go to college. And I guess I want to encourage people to take a broader view of what a good job might consist of.
Well, for me, the idea of a good job is something I would love to do, which is why I have been here for as long as I have. Is that your own thinking as well?
Oh, I think the intrinsic satisfactions of the work we do is, that's really what the book is about. And the economic argument is sort of peripheral to it. And the tragedy, I think, is that the kid who feels kind of hustled off to college, and say he becomes a B or C student in college, and you know, because he's not really engaged, it doesn't feel like the right place for him. And then maybe he goes on to become, say, a mediocre accountant. Well, that same kid might have become a crack electrician and be really engaged in what he's doing and enjoying it for that reason.
It seems to me that what you're saying, what you're calling for, what you're asking for is the return of those shop classes to junior high and high school to give not only boys but girls the opportunity to get their hands on equipment, whatever it is.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, there are some efforts in this direction. There's something I've just learned about called the Nuts and Bolts Foundation that is trying to sort of rehabilitate shop class in schools. And John Ratzenberger, the guy who runs it, he sees really this as being about the fate of Western civilization. I mean, that might sound extreme, but I think there's something to that. If we sort of lose the ability to make things and fix things, we really become dependent on others to do those things for us.
There has been a long history, however, as you reported from that cocktail party conversation you had of assuming that someone who works with his or her hands rather than in some intellectual pursuit in a cubicle, that that person who works in a shop or an automobile mechanical situation is not using the mind.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people assume that if the work is dirty, that it must be stupid. And that's just, that's not my experience. Say you're trying to diagnose why a car doesn't idle properly. That's not a trivial task. There can be many causes. So you develop, you know, a number of hypotheses and you start pursuing them. And you often find that the possible causes all interact with one another. So it can be very difficult to isolate them. And there comes a point where you have to sort of step back and rely more on hunches than sort of explicit rule following. And I think there's a lot of jobs that where the person who designs the job tries to reduce it to following rules. And mechanical diagnosis is something where that you can never fully do that. And that's a source of satisfaction because you're always using your own mind. You're never just following a procedure.
Give us some examples of the frustrations you've experienced in your own work history.
Well, I had a job. This was after I got a master's degree. I had to quit school and go work for a while.
What was your master's in?
In social science.
Okay.
Yeah. So I landed a job writing abstracts, that is, summaries of articles in scientific journals and other academic journals, which sounded like an exciting job. I thought, I'm going to learn so much from reading these and writing summaries of them. Well, the job turned out to be a little different than I had thought. By the time I left after 11 months, my quota was 23 articles per day. If Diane is...
I'm just aghast.
Yeah. Well, if it sounds impossible, that's because it was. And so the way the job was set up was that they told me that, well, all you have to do is follow these procedures for taking an article and writing a summary of it. And of course, what I produced then was really not very good, shall we say. So it was a job that I landed because I had this academic credential, but the job turned out to actually require me to not think, because the more you think, they can only slow you down in that kind of work. It was like an intellectual assembly line.
It really is amazing to hear you talk this way, because I think so many people aspire to this kind of position because they feel it will give them not only the prestige, the salary that they're looking for, but the intellectual excitement. And what you're saying is that there was none.
Not in this job. And the other part of this is that the salary was $23,000 a year. Now, previously, I'd worked as an electrician, and I was making twice that on an average day and three times that on a good day. So it was a matter of getting this credential and feeling like I'd been inducted into this order of society, you know, and I wore beautiful ties. But it turned out to really to be a more kind of proletarian existence than I'd known as an electrician.
So what was the transition like for you from doing this kind of cubicle work to opening a motorcycle repair shop? I have to understand how you made that transition.
Well, it was there were circumstances that made it possible. For one thing, Richmond is a place that has a lot of very inexpensive warehouse space. So I went in with someone else to share warehouse space, and we were both fixing motorcycles there together. And it was tremendously exciting. It was.
How old were you at the time?
Let's see. I guess this would have been, early 30s, mid-30s, something like that.
What did your parents have to say? Well, I mean, after having watched you go through this long educational process and then seeing you turn to motorcycle repair, what was their reaction?
Well, my mother is very, very supportive. She's a wonderful woman, and I don't know if she fully understood the appeal of this, but she's someone who has faith in me, and having someone like that in your corner really helps.
And your father?
My father had passed on around this time.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see. So making the transition seem natural, or did you have lots of bumps along that road?
Oh, yeah, lots of bumps. I mean, it's running a small business is no cakewalk, and the business goes up and down. So at various points, I've supplemented it with writing. One thing I love about it is that it embeds me in a community. You're dealing with motorcyclists, and motorcyclists are passionate about motorcycling. And if you're the guy who fixes their bike, then they tend to like you. And that's it's kind of like one of my early jobs was scooping ice cream. And when you're giving someone an ice cream cone,
they
love you. Yeah.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's open the phones. We've got lots of callers. 800-433-8850. First, let's go to Benjamin, who's in Berlin, Germany. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I wanted to give a call just because I've been hearing about this particular book and really appreciate the perspective offered by the author. And I also have a lot of the same sort of background history as the author, having grown up on a farm in Rhode Island, on tractors and old machinery that needed to be sort of fixed and felt out and looked at before it could be, corrected or adjusted. Just the whole way of knowing things through your hands and through your body versus through the mind, I'd say, and then later share the experience of going to the University of Chicago. So feel a great, I completely take your argument to heart. And what I wanted to add was that 3 years ago I moved to Germany, and what I learned here is that the education system does embrace the trades and does embrace working with your hands, but it comes at a sort of cost, if you will, in that very early on, around the ages of, I'd say, between 8 and 10 years old, they separate students through testing and put certain students in training programs and certain students in more academic tracks. But in many ways, it embraces exactly what the author has been talking about.
Benjamin,
I hope that the American system would catch up in some ways to this.
Yeah, the question I would have there is, knowing that the European system does offer this to track, is 8 or 10 too early an age to make such a crucial decision?
Oh, I think it is. If it means that someone's life is determined in that way, I mean, I'm probably one of the kids who would have ended up on that track. I wasn't a serious student as a youngster, and I think that tracking is probably rooted in this misperception that I'm trying to address, namely that using your hand and using your mind are these two very distinct things. As a practical problem, I don't know, do you really need to track people that way in order to have a serious education in sort of craftsmanship, I suppose, or some kind of specialization that has to happen fairly early on? And I don't know, I don't really have a policy prescription on that. I want to kind of reflect on what's at stake in these choices more than tell anyone what to do about it.
And to provide the opportunities all the way through, certainly that primary education, to make those choices.
Yeah, I mean, they have to be available to begin
with.
And, you know, as I said before, I think some kids who are very smart, and may even be academically smart, you know, the opportunity to just take a tool in hand and see a direct effect of your actions in the world. There's something deeply human about that.
Taking a hammer in hand. Matthew Crawford. He's both a philosopher and a mechanic, author of a new book. It's titled Shop Class as Soulcraft, An Inquiry into the Value of Work. When we come back, more of your questions, comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org, by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A recent study found a majority of women want a better work-life balance. How some are saying no to overly demanding jobs, even in tough economic times. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour.
And now we'll go right to the phones to Steve in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
I just wanted to say that I'm a musician. I had been working in the film scoring industry, which is a highly technical field, spending hours and hours in front of a computer, and found myself sort of longing for something to do that was not sort of computer-oriented. So I started fixing my own cars, making my own musical instruments, and I started to use that as sort of a therapy. It became very therapeutic for me, and it really helped me to save my love for my job rather than replacing it. And so I still continue now to do my own automobile repair and all that kind of stuff, and it just really helps to keep me interested in my first chosen career.
I think that's really interesting. Right, so there's a whole kind of do-it-yourself movement that seems to be thriving. And I wonder if part of it may be sort of just what you describe, where sometimes that experience of individual agency can be elusive at work. If you're working in an office, often the sort of chain of cause and effect is a little confusing and opaque. And responsibility tends to get spread around.
bureaucracy.
And, yeah, right. And so, you know, someone will build a home addition or knit a sweater and get that satisfaction at home. And the book, Shop Class of Soulcraft, is really about that, too. It's not just about work. It's about our efforts to achieve some kind of self-reliance as consumers.
Steve, I'm so glad you called. Thank you.
Thank you.
And here's an email from Don, who says, sorry, it's just too painful. The joys of manual labor are obvious, but the opportunities are just gone. There are hundreds of thousands of make-stuff people who have no jobs. GM today is basically shipping its jobs to China. Why? Because there are no worker rights or environmental laws there. Kucinich was talking about this on C-SPAN today. The American Make Things ethic was not based on making things. It was based on the freedom to make those things, and that freedom is dying as we sell out to third world countries where workers are basically slaves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this problem of manufacturing, which, you know, obviously manufacturing has left our shores to a very disturbing degree. And that last email message, I think, is hits an important point about that. The distinction I want to make is between making things and the kind of manual trades that have to be done on site. So what the electrician does can never be outsourced to China. What the mechanic does can't be outsourced. The Indians can't fix your car for you because they're in India and your car is here. So there are kinds of work that are sort of exist in the cracks that are immune to that kind of logic of outsourcing. And the very important point about manufacturing going overseas, that same logic is now applying to many products of intellectual labor because they can be delivered over a wire.
Intellectual labor going overseas as well.
Yeah, right. As I mentioned, the work that editors do, the work that radiologists do. A doctor who treats patients, he'll never have his job sent away.
All right, and to Wendy in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Good morning, you're on the air. Wendy, are you there?
Hi. Go right ahead, please. This is Wendy from Chapel Hill, and I mainly called because I was in a similar situation, having majored in philosophy, and found myself a single mom with no source of income. And I resorted to, wonderfully, apprenticeships. I apprenticed with a Native American who was a master saddle maker, and I have ended up as a leather artisan. And in addition, I apprenticed with a dog groomer and can now have in my home a dog grooming studio. Apprenticeships are wonderful in that they cost me nothing, and the master benefits from having the extra help.
What a great thought.
Yeah, apprenticeship and also entrepreneurship, the dog grooming thing. I think if there is any silver lining in the economic mess right now, it may be that we become more entrepreneurial if the usual career tracks have sort of been scrambled. We're thrown back on our own devices. And I think ultimately entrepreneurship is a sounder basis for an economy than the sort of highly managerial economy with so many layers of different sort of interests skimming off of the labor of those who are actually doing things.
And here's someone who's experienced exactly that. Good morning, Mike. You're in Gainesville, Florida.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a big fan of the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to echo what Matthew has been saying. I'm a former internet marketer who graduated from college with a history degree, got into internet marketing, and now I'm looking to get into the rock climbing gym industry. I found that internet marketing is something that I can kind of do on the side, and I'm looking to do that more cubicle-type job to take up time during the day whenever I have free time for the rock climbing, or free time from the rock climbing gym. My main job, I guess, is now transitioning to almost a side job.
Now, how difficult are you finding the transition?
Not very. Rock climbing is my passion, and right now I'm actually in the entrepreneurial aspects, trying to determine how financially viable the gym aspect is going to be. But I'm really, I don't know, I really felt like what Matthew was saying earlier about the kid who didn't do too well in college. I went to college, and I did really well in high school, but once I got to college, I kind of just sort of played around and didn't do too well. And I found that doing internet marketing, I was making a lot of money for other people, and I really just wanted to do something that's more real. It's just not as ethereal, I guess.
Sounds to me as though he's coming right out of your book, Matthew.
It's really good to hear from Mike in Gatesville. And it seems like a theme that keeps coming up with callers is sort of the things that we do in our leisure time that we may or may not try to turn into a business. And it's so let me tell you a story about this is sort of a hypothetical guy. Let's call him Bob. And he takes his car into a dealership to get it fixed. And it's an older car. And they come back and tell him, well, the car is not worth fixing. And he's told this by not by a mechanic, but by someone holding a clipboard. So there's a kind of layer of bureaucracy in the way. And he would love to talk to the mechanic and sort of get the nitty-gritty of the situation. But this isn't allowed. And he hates the feeling of dependence, especially when there's something he doesn't understand. So he gets his car towed home, and he starts taking it apart for himself, because he figures that whatever the problem is, he ought to be able to figure it out by his own efforts.
Has he ever done this before?
Well, that's the thing. He quickly realizes he may never get his engine back together again, but he intends to go down swinging. And I think that kind of spiritedness or pride...
passion.
Yeah. It's when we have this desire to be master of our own stuff, it elicits that kind of spiritedness and also a spirit of inquiry, taking things apart to get at the bottom of things.
I can remember learning to sew and trying to begin to understand the instructions for sewing and reading and reading and applying and applying, taking sleeves out 20 times to get it right. But that feel of that fabric and the knowledge that what I was doing was ultimately going to create a dress or a suit or a jacket or whatever kept me going.
Yeah, it's amazing how your work can get energized by that feeling that you're progressing in your skill and that there's something, it's almost like something about the world is coming into clearer view through just what you described, taking it apart, doing it over, your sort of ability to perceive the world is getting sharper.
Let's go now to Stephanie, who's in Cincinnati. Good morning, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a high school college advisor, and I also tutor dyslexic children, so I kind of have some two different perspectives. But I think what we're really talking about is a different kind of intelligence. It really is an intelligence that these individuals have that needs to be respected. And I think as educators, a lot of us don't understand the minds of these individuals. Often when I meet with students when they're juniors in high school and we're, you know, and I'm looking at the transcript, and if it's very low, I'm often relieved to find that this student is very interested in maybe culinary arts or an apprenticeship program or visual and performing arts, because their brains are just different. But it really is a different kind of intelligence. And the measures that we use in schools does not measure their strengths and their abilities, and they often don't get the feedback that they need to even know about these other choices that they can have in life.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do think, you know, and working with them, that they don't feel that this is a valued way to go in life because they're put up against, you know, other kids with, you know, 4.0 GPAs. And so it's hard to make them feel good about the choices that they want to make.
Do you believe it's a different kind of intelligence? Or are we the ones who are measuring intelligence differently?
Yeah. I think the caller makes a really important point, and that's about sort of honoring the different ways that people have of learning and different ways of making one's way in the world, and you know, being able to do well on a standardized test is not the be-all end-all of intelligence. And but you were asking just now, Diane, whether I think they're... Sorry, repeat your question.
The notion that how we measure intelligence.
Yes.
Do we break it apart, or do we honor, as you say, the different kinds of intelligence and say this is intelligence?
Yeah, I think that's a crucial point, actually, that, you know, measuring people's IQ and giving them tests, that serves certain institutional purposes, right? An institution has to be able to put people in boxes sort of for its own sort of administrative reasons. But those reasons shouldn't necessarily be our own reasons. And it's easy to sort of get intimidated by that kind of sorting and classifying. I think the crucial distinction for a young person is to find their own sort of niche.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show and to Winston-Salem. Good morning, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Matthew, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Great, great. Wonderful topic. I've been in the printing industry for 30 years, and 10 of those taught voc ed at the junior high school, and college level. And in my observation in 30 years is that it comes down to a generational concept that my kids are going to have better than I had. And as that develops over the years, you'll see that the college requirements that the Board of Governors at the state level institute really eliminates class time for kids to take voc ed classes anymore. And it really was at the peak in the 1970s, voc ed was. And then as the computer technology came on, I think you saw more and more of those voc ed classes dissipate and go by the wayside. Hmm. And I really think that we have lost a basic belief that working with your hands is a good thing, that my kids are going to have better than I had. And that's my comment on
that. All right, sir.
I think it's a good point about this. There's a kind of academic arms race, and parents feel that they have to get their kids well armed for this race. And what it leads to is a kind of credential inflation, so that the same job that might have been done by a high school graduate 30 years ago, well, now if you're an employer, you just use the college degree as a kind of automatic cutoff, you know, without even looking at other people. And that this sort of, there's an escalating demand for academic credentials, so that, you know, the MA is maybe like the BS used to be. And often this is sort of floats free of actual learning. It's a kind of, what matters is your rank among your peers more than whether or not you've actually learned anything. Mm.
Finally, here's an email from Todd, who's listening on station WVGR. He says, I was trained as an architect and enjoyed working with my hands, drafting and building models. All of that was replaced by computers. I enjoyed the accuracy of the computers, but missed using my hands. Now I work as a farrier shoeing horses' feet. most people do not see any connection and just assume I was not a good architect. I still enjoy both. That's really putting the finger on it, isn't it?
Yeah, I've heard from a number of architects, and I always love their stories. They tend to be very interesting people. And one thing I've heard is that once upon a time, architects usually had some building experience. They knew the materials. They knew what you could do and what you couldn't do. And what I hear is that a lot of architects now don't have that background, and that as a result, the people doing the actual building often sort of chuckle at the drawings and have to sort of throw it aside.
Matthew Crawford, his new book is titled Shop Class as Soul Craft, An Inquiry into the Value of Work. I hope your book really gets into classrooms around this country and helps people understand work in a different way. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.